Omar Khadr's trial before the Obama administration's newly fashioned military commission began on August 10th of this year. But during the first day of proceedings, his sole lawyer, Army Lieutenant Colonel John Jackson, collapsed due to illness and the trial was postponed. Colonel Patrick Parrish, the Army judge presiding over the case, has set a new date, October 18th, for the short-lived trial to resume. Evidence obtained through coerced interrogation has already been deemed admissible during the pretrial, contrary to the promise made by the Obama administration that such evidence would be prohibited. Even if Khadr's trial resumes, it could be upended by a case being heard at the D.C. Circuit Court that is contesting the legality of the military commissions of 2009. Where Khadr's case might finally be decided is still somewhat of a mystery, but it is commonly accepted that if the Canadian government had intervened on his behalf and requested repatriation, the United States would have acquiesced, as it has with almost every other foreign national held at Guantanamo.
Speaker, our position regarding Mr. Khadr remains unchanged. It is exactly the same position as two previous Liberal governments, Mr. Speaker. The problem here, Mr. Speaker, is that no charges have been dropped against this individual on the one hand. Where there is inconsistency,
the Canadian government has been surprisingly silent on the issue of Khadr's detention, and has essentially only addressed the issue when forced to, most notably when brought before domestic courts. Tony Navanieland, counsel at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association in Toronto, discusses the Canadian government's hesitancy to act on behalf of Khadr.
Now, of course, you have a majority of Canadians now who think Omar Khadr should be repatriated. Like I said, as I said before, there is a split in that group between whether he should be released or charged here in Canada or subject to some kind of peace bond. You have the Supreme Court twice telling you you've committed abuses abroad. You have all three opposition parties telling you he should be repatriated. So there's kind of this wall of support against, or up against the government to say, do something on this case. And the Canadian government has, especially this Conservative administration, has dug their heels in. They are simply almost impervious to criticism on this issue or to public sway on this issue. They have come to a conclusion that Omar Khadr should face trial in the United States under the military commission process, and that they will not intervene.
Canada's connection to the Khadr case goes back to the early stages of his detention at Guantanamo. In February and September of 2003, agents from CSIS and the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade questioned Khadr at Guantanamo.
I don't want to talk to this Omar.
It was an eye.
Yes, it was.
You see, you're not going to believe me.
Well, look me straight in the eyes and tell me that you're being honest.
I am being honest.
Omar, you can't even bear to look at me when you're saying that.
I can't bear to look at you.
You know, put your hand down.
No, you don't care about me.
Okay, look, I want to... Let's take a few minutes. Yeah, take a break. Have a little bit to eat before your hamburger is killed. All right, relax a bit. That's not true. People do care.
Instead of making inquiries about the state of Khadr's detention and ensuring that he, as a Canadian citizen, was being detained in keeping with the practices of fundamental law, Canadian officials interrogated Khadr with the intent of providing assistance to his American captors. Moreover, in March of 2004, Khadr was again interrogated by a Department of Foreign Affairs official who, prior to the interrogation, was informed that Khadr had been subject to sleep deprivation.
There was a report from one of the RCMP officers who went down, one of the Department of Foreign Affairs officers who went down to Guantanamo Bay in one of the interrogations. The report is a report from that officer who kind of says in very simple terms, not a lot of emotion or underlining or exclamation points, that prior to one of his interrogations of Omar Khadr, a U.S. officer has informed him that Omar Khadr has been placed in what's called the Frequent Flyer Program, which is a sleep deprivation program. So in that case, the officer is informed that for 21 days, 2 weeks prior to this interrogation, Omar Khadr has not been allowed to sleep in one location for more than 3 hours. He's moved every 3 hours with the goal of creating psychological exhaustion, psychological trauma, which makes you more willing to talk. Moreover, the officer is told the whole purpose of this frequent flyer program was for the interview with the Canadians. They felt Omar trusted the Canadians, that he would be vulnerable to interrogation by a Canadian, that he would not feel as, say, threatened that he would around an American interrogator. So the whole sleep deprivation program was done to aid this Canadian interrogation.
The information acquired during these interrogations was turned over to the United States and used against Khadr during his hearing before the Combatant Status Review Tribunal. At the hearing, Khadr was labeled an enemy combatant, making his detention legal under American law. The summary of evidence memo from the hearing states that the CSIS and Department of Foreign Affairs interrogations provided significant evidence in support of the charge. Following the hearing, Khadr brought a motion before the Canadian court seeking an injunction to prevent Canadian officials from interviewing him further, which was granted. Khadr was formally charged under the military commissions in February of 2005, and the material support provided by Canada to the U.S. prosecution became the basis for the court challenges heard in Canadian courts. The first case, known as Khadr 1, sought the disclosure of all documents relevant to the charges in the possession of the Crown, including records of the interviews. These requests were initially denied, but the Federal Court of Appeals overturned the decision of the Federal Court and stated that the documents be produced before the court for review under the Canada Evidence Act. The Crown then turned to the Supreme Court, requesting that the appeal be turned aside. However, the Supreme Court upheld the ruling on the basis that Canadian officials had been involved in a foreign process that violated Canada's international law obligations. The Supreme Court's ruling in Khadr 1 opened the door for the case that would come to be known as Khadr 2. In identifying that the government had been complicit in state conduct that violates the principles of fundamental justice, the court determined that Khadr's charter right under Section 7 had been violated. Section 7 states that everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right not to be deprived thereof, except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. This ruling allowed Khadr's Canadian lawyers to seek remedy for the charter breach, and Justice O'Reilly of the Federal Court ordered that Canada remedy the breach by requesting that the United States repatriate Khadr to Canada as soon as possible. The Crown appealed on the grounds that the courts do not have the rights to dictate measures of foreign policy as stipulated in the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade Act. The appeal was turned down, and the case was brought before the Supreme Court, which upheld the ruling, but altered the remedy, stating that the breach of Khadr's charter right is ongoing and that the remedy sought, which was asking the United States to repatriate Khadr to Canada, could potentially vindicate those rights. However, instead of prescribing a specific remedy, the court ordered that an appropriate and just remedy be sought, one that meaningfully vindicates the rights and freedoms of the claimants. While the Supreme Court ruling in Khadr 2 held that Khadr's human and legal rights had been violated, it also allowed the government to decide the appropriate course of action to remedy the situation. So how did the Canadian government remedy the charter breach identified by the courts? They sent a single diplomatic note requesting that evidence obtained during the CSIS and Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade interrogations not be used during Khadr's upcoming trial. The United States' response was that Khadr's trial would be subject to the laws set forth in the Military Commissions Act of 2009. And in pre-trial motions, the evidence obtained through Canadian interrogations has already been deployed, meaning that the Canadian request has not provided any sort of remedy for the charter breach. The following is an exchange between Lawrence Cannon, Foreign Minister of Canada, and the media about the Supreme Court ruling and the government's 1.5-page response.
Mr. Cannon, could you tell us how your government came to the decision not to request Mr. Khadr's return to Canada after the Supreme Court decision? We heard from the Prime Minister's office today that there's been no change in position on the return of Mr. Khadr.
Well, there hasn't been a change in position.
How did you get to that decision?
Well, how did we get to that decision? It's exactly the same decision that we have taken since the very outset of this incident, or at least of this file. You'll recall that we, of course, respect the decision of the Obama administration has taken to close down Guantanamo, but at the same time to make sure that those people who are held and that have charges that are being put forward and that they are facing, that indeed the American justice system go forward. That has been our position from the beginning. We've said that Mr. Khadr is facing serious charges. As you will recall, Mr. Khadr is being held by the Americans because of his involvement, or alleged involvement, I should say, in the murder of an American military officer, who indeed, I should say, American medical officer, who died in an incident, and he's being held on those charges. We continue to provide consular services. We have done so. Mr. Khadr is receiving all the services that normally we would provide any other citizen in that regard.
What about his rights violation?
I'm finishing my question, Jennifer. And in that regard...
What about his rights violation?
In that regard, we will continue. We will continue to monitor the situation as we've been doing, and my understanding is that the Americans will make a determination on that, and we will let the Americans make that determination.
And once that is done, we will see what the next steps are.
This year, the Supreme Court reviewed the government's actions with respect to the charter breach outlined in Khadr 2, and found that the Canadian government had not received assurance from the United States that the evidence obtained by Canadian officials would not be used, meaning the court order set out in Khadr 2 had not been met. For a second time, the Supreme Court implored the government to take action to remedy, or at least ameliorate, Khadr's situation, but the Crown has since appealed. The government's inaction with regard to Khadr's detainment has caused law students and professors throughout Canada to form the Omar Khadr Project, which has actively been advocating that the government respect its obligations with regard to human rights, international law, and the Canadian Charter of Rights. But as Tony Navanilan explains, domestic opinion has been divided.
Well, I think Omar Khadr, when you hear his name in Canada, it tends to bring up one or two emotions amongst most people, either anger or apathy, neither of which are very productive for the cause of either repatriating him or finding him a just solution in the United States. In terms of advocates, to be honest, some of the more usual characters you'd expect to see involved in a case like this were slow to get involved. A lot of the opposition parties were very slow to voice concern about the current government's position. That has to do a lot with the fact that some of the abuses actually occurred while the Liberal government was in power here. And so the Liberal government has been very reluctant until perhaps the last year to really speak out on the issue.
The Canadian government has not only been slow to respond in Khadr's case. Mayor Arar, who was arrested at JFK Airport in New York in 2002, was deported to Syria, where he was imprisoned for over a year and tortured before being returned to Canada without any charges having been brought against him. Despite the fact that Arar was cleared by a public inquiry, the government has continued to fail to fulfill its responsibilities to those of its citizens who were unjustly detained in other countries.
This is a government that thinks, you know, the Constitution and the protections of the Canadian passport do not travel with you abroad. For whatever reason, they've come to that conclusion. That seems to be the conclusion they've come to. Now, these are cases like Omar Khadr, of course, is the most salient, but of course, Abdul Razak, who is a gentleman trapped in Khartoum, Sudan, for over a year, living in the lobby of the Canadian embassy, asking for a Canadian passport. He's a Canadian citizen, and the government refused to issue him that passport. In all these cases, you've seen this government's opinion that if you are abroad and that you are in some way responsible for the circumstances you find yourself in, from the government's point of view, you will not get any assistance from Ottawa. And the fact you have a Canadian passport, the fact you were born here in Canada, like Omar Khadr was, means next to nothing.
Tony Navanilan is now one of many who are concerned that Canada's traditional role as an advocate of international law and human rights is being undermined.
As Canadians, the issues in Mr. Khadr's case should be alarming. They are the gold standard in human rights abuses, if I can use that term. They're the issues of torture. They're the issues of child soldiers, or the issue of an unfair trial. These are kind of benchmark issues, and a lot of them, Canada's been at the forefront of them, of advocating for the eradication of those kinds of abuses. So you have something called, say, the United Nations Optional Protocol on Child Soldiers, a special treaty on child soldiers that Canada is, in fact, the first country in the world to ratify. And we went around the world to countries like Sierra Leone and Uganda and Sri Lanka, and we told them, you must sign this treaty, too, because you have serious child soldier issues in your country. And those countries were experiencing serious civil conflict, and we told them, you know, it doesn't matter. You have to sign this kind of treaty. We were huge supporters of the International Criminal Court, whose very first prosecution is the recruitment of child soldiers. And Canadians supported these kind of endeavors enormously. They were very popular in our foreign policy, and we defined ourselves around them. So to see initially, about, I'd say, 3 or 4 years ago, about 80% of Canadians did not want to see Omar Khadr repatriated, a Canadian citizen who was recruited as a child into armed conflict, it was very discouraging, and it was very, I think, shaking in terms of what we think Canadian values are, how Canadians perceive themselves in terms of foreign policy and human rights. For me personally, it definitely undermined a lot of my faith in what I thought were the values that this country was founded upon, that our foreign policy is founded upon. So I'd say for me, the average Canadian really was the most surprising obstacle in terms of the campaign for repatriation.
Omar Khadr is 23 today. He's been detained since he was 15 years old. There are a number of international treaties and protocols that govern the treatment of children during international conflicts and outline measures to protect them within international law. These include the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child and its optional protocol, as well as a number of UN guidelines and rules that set standards for how children are to be treated under international law. Among the guidelines set forth in these documents, the United States has breached the rules concerning the allowed length of detention and proper determination of cases against children, subjecting children to torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, separating children from adults, allowing children to maintain contact with their families, the right to education and recreation while deprived of liberty, and the right to a specialized juvenile justice system and rehabilitation. These international guidelines have also condemned trying children in military courts. The Paris Principles, to which Canada is a signatory, declare that
children who are accused of crimes under international law allegedly committed while they were associated with armed forces or armed groups should be considered primarily as victims of offenses against international law, not only as perpetrators. They must be treated in accordance with international law in a framework of restorative justice and social rehabilitation. Consistent with international law, which offers children special protection through numerous agreements and principles.
The optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child prohibits the recruitment or use in hostilities by non-state armed groups of under 18-year-olds and requires states to provide any such child who comes within their jurisdiction all appropriate assistance for their physical and psychological recovery and their social reintegration. Andrea Prasau, senior counsel at Human Rights Watch's Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program, argues that while the United States is not legally bound, it is strongly urged by international law to take into account Khadr's age at the time of his capture.
International juvenile justice standards make it very clear that while it is not illegal under international law to prosecute someone who was a juvenile at the time they were captured, it is strongly disfavored. The purpose of looking at accused child soldiers in international law, the purpose of taking them into custody, is to remove them from the dangerous battlefield and to rehabilitate them. And Omar Khadr has never had an opportunity for rehabilitation.
At the same time, the Military Commissions Act of 2009 makes no mention of the word child, but only defines those it classifies as alien, unlawful, enemy belligerents as persons, whose age is irrelevant.
The one thing that it is fair to criticize the United States for is that the language of the protocol does specifically say that it uses the term victims when it's referring to child soldiers, people between 15 and 18, and it calls for emphasis to be given to their rehabilitation and social reintegration. So certainly that language can be read to suggest that you capture someone between 15 and 18 and they're supposed to be treated differently than adult captives. But there's nothing in either of these provisions that specifically says that you can't hold a juvenile who does participate in armed conflict criminally accountable for any war crimes that they might commit.
While Carter's defense may struggle to legally bind the United States to treat Carter as a child soldier in accordance with international law, there is a strong case to be made for the psychological impact of the interrogation and indefinite detention Carter has undergone. This is also one of the reasons the defense will cite to argue for limiting Carter's sentence, should he be convicted at the trial. Dr. Stephen Reisner, adjunct professor in the program of clinical psychology at Columbia University, explains the psychological impact of the interrogation and indefinite detention Carter has undergone.
I think that to some extent, the psychological consequences are survival mechanisms that he's developing to handle, if it's at all possible to handle, the situation he's in now. I mean, what you have is someone who has made an adjustment to an impossible circumstance. The issue is whether the adjustments that he's made to the circumstances he's in now will haunt him and remain with him after he's released or when he's put, you know, somewhere else. And that is very likely to happen. It is very likely that the level of distrust, the level of fear, the level of panic at certain events or certain changes, these are all the symptoms of trauma. But to understand the symptoms of trauma, one has to understand that they come from a circumstance which itself was unbearable and which one had to adjust to at the time appropriately. And so his situation now is not necessarily one of somebody who's traumatized, but someone who's adjusted to a terrifying and impossible circumstance. Now, the problem, of course, is that will plague him even after he's no longer in that circumstance, which I think we can expect. We would expect that just because the circumstance around him changes doesn't mean that all the ways he's developed to cope with that circumstance are going to magically leave and that he's going to be able to be free of them. Some people who are very resilient and strong are able to do that. Many people are. But in Kadar's case, he was young when it began. In terms of percentage of his life, he's been in this circumstance for a very, very, very long time. So it is unfortunately likely that he will be plagued with the personality and character and responses that he's developed in prison for a long time afterwards, and that's what would really have to be addressed psychologically.
Aside from the traumatic effects on Carter's person and his emotional maturation, the detentions at Guantanamo, particularly of children, have been known to deliver the defendants to their respective trials in an extremely fragile state. Mohammed Jawad, who, like Omar Khadr, was accused of murder in violation of international law and detained at Guantanamo before being repatriated to Afghanistan in 2009, showed clear signs of mental instability when he appeared at his military commission's hearing on the 12th of March 2008. The following is an excerpt from Amnesty International's Human Rights Observer's report from the hearing.
Mohammed Jawad would often rub his forehead and put his head in his hands. At times he rocked forward and exhaled audibly. When he put his hands to his head, the guards behind him would remove them and place them back on the table. Mohammed Jawad subsequently removed his headphones and put his head on the desk. The judge asked him to put them back on, but he said he could not, that he was suffering from a severe headache and that years of being under bright fluorescent lights had made him permanently ill. He replaced the headphones, but eventually took them off again and asked the judge not to bother him anymore. At one point, he had his fingers in his ears, but eventually just put his head down on the table and did not raise it again for the rest of the proceedings.
To some extent, one thing that has interfered is that the use of the techniques that they have been implementing, the repeated waterboarding, the intense isolation, has rendered their defendants, these detainees, some of them very, very ill. And many of them can't participate in their own defense. Many of them can't be brought to trial in any public way because you see what the effects of the torture has been on them. And I think that they can't make a case because of the mental incapacitation of the detainees due to the interrogation techniques.
Were Cotter's case to come to an end, Dr. Reisner predicts a long period of rehabilitation, though it may be easier for Cotter, as a child, to be reintegrated into society.
Child soldiers often are reincorporated into the community more easily than adult soldiers who have engaged in criminal activity, because people recognize that children are very easily influenced, and they put them back into the community a lot more easily because they don't hold them so responsible. With an opportunity to join a community, there, you know, would certainly be hope for his future. But so I think that there are therapeutic steps, there are, you know, family and community steps, there are government steps. I think that the harm that he's been caused, from how I see his treatment and from how I see his history, goes way above and beyond the culpability that he may have. There's a kind of justice and reconciliation that would be required that would take quite a bit of time and goes beyond his individual treatment.
Andrea Prasow believes that the psychologist's appraisal of Cotter's medical condition will be crucial in determining the outcome of the case.
In terms of the factual issues, what I think will be most interesting is that if Omar is convicted, whether it's of murder or one of the other subsidiary charges, the jury will then have the opportunity to hear from psychiatrists who have examined Omar to talk about his mental state, to try to mitigate any sentence that they might issue. And that's where I think the case will become very interesting, and that's where his abuse will come out.
David Glazier says that the recent postponement of Cotter's trial could have given the Obama administration time to negotiate a plea bargain with the defense. Cotter is reported to have rejected such a plea bargain, saying that he would not give in to an unjust judicial procedure.
A number of commentators seem to think that what the government would really like to do is simply have this go away, and that the easiest way to do that is going to be to negotiate some sort of plea deal. And given the fact that we've had this delay because of his lawyer's illness, it may very well be that they're working behind the scenes in Washington to try to come up with a deal that he would accept. Now, supposedly, Cotter was offered a deal that would require him to serve something like 5 years, and as a matter of principle, he said no, but, you know, maybe if it was 1 year or a year and a half or something that he would recognize that even though, you know, as a matter of principle, it strikes him as wrong, that it would be much better than actually, you know, going to trial.
Given how contentious the charges against Cotter are, and the fact that the military commission's shortcomings in jurisdiction have been exposed through his case, Andrea Prasow believes Cotter's defense has good grounds for appeal, should the trial result in a conviction.
Well, I think there are some very valid grounds for an appeal. Some of the problems with the Military Commissions Act apply directly to Omar Khadr's case, that the Military Commissions Act only applies to non-U.S. citizens, that it purports to prosecute people for crimes that are not violations of the laws of war. And in fact, Omar is charged with a crime called murder in violation of the laws of war, which is not a crime. It's not a violation of the law of war. And it's sort of a very complicated legal issue, but suffice it to say, I think there's a valid legal challenge.
There is also a hypothetical chance that the Canadian government will come to Cotter's aid. But even if the government did choose to repatriate Cotter, the opportunity to do so is diminishing as the trial approaches.
All this litigation is running against a time clock, of course, because there is kind of a general consensus and common sense out there that once the trial begins, once Omar Khadr's trial begins, and in particular once it concludes, the possibilities of repatriation become much more complicated and much less likely in a way. So in many respects, the litigation is running up against a time clock that is counting down very rapidly, as you know, because the trial is scheduled to begin in October.
Omar Khadr's detention and trial have highlighted some of the most uncomfortable truths about the illegalities of the military commission's procedure. The dreadful absence of due process at Guantanamo Bay, and the inadequate grounds upon which Khadr himself is being charged. Aside from expressing concern for the United States' chosen methods in dealing with detainees captured in the current conflict, the interviewees we spoke with were also concerned with what precedent will be set by the United States with respect to future applications of international law.
Other countries have been watching what the U.S. has been doing over the last 9 years and have watched the Obama administration proceed with some of the really terrible aspects of the Bush administration, including military commissions. And I think that puts the U.S. in a very dangerous position. The U.S. advocates against ad hoc military tribunals in other countries, yet uses them itself. The U.S. advocates against preventive detention in other countries, yet appears to be using it itself. So I think that really weakens the power of the U.S. to help ensure compliance with international law globally.
To the extent that other countries are inspired by the U.S. example to sort of treat non-traditional conflicts, fights against terrorist groups as matters of war, and then sort of distort the rules to really undermine the traditional equality between combatants, which is sort of a fundamental principle of the law of war, then other countries could certainly do a lot of sort of evil, malevolent things using this as a precedent.
You've been listening to a two-part documentary about the trial against Omar Khadr and the legal process at the military commissions. This documentary was produced by Sven Carlson and Sam Ormond for the CKUT News Collective. Special thanks go out to Maya, Gretchen, and AJ for their help in the production process.